for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last month, NASA administrators made a surprising announcement. There would be no new flagship missions costing more than $1 billion. As Washington Post reporter Joel Achenbach writes, the space community feels it's facing a new era of limits, even as the universe itself is screaming to be explored. Joining me to talk about the next frontier in space exploration, Joel Achenbach of The Washington Post, Lori Garver, former NASA Deputy Administrator, and Scott Pace, Director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Welcome to all of you.
Hello.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good mornings.
Joel Achenbach, I love that phrase, that the universe is screaming to be explored. What do you mean?
Well, what a wonderful time to be involved with space science. Just a few weeks back, they announced, based on the Kepler Space Telescope viewing of the galaxy, that it looks like there probably are tens of millions potentially of potentially habitable planets in our galaxy. Now, we don't know if they actually have life, but this is a period in which the study of our galaxy and the discovery of these exoplanets is very exciting. Plus, you have all these scientific missions going on Mars. The Cassini mission to Saturn has been a big success. There's a lot of excitement about a recent discovery that Europa appears to have these plumes of water shooting out of the south pole of Europa. That's one of the moons of Jupiter. So it's a very exciting time in science, and the scientists are saying, give us some more money to do some more big missions.
And, Lori Garver, that is precisely the problem. Not enough money for NASA.
I'm not sure it is, actually. I believe that NASA and their $17 billion has an incredibly exciting and important space program. Of course, we could do even more with our $17 billion, and I think if we did that, we would engender that support from the public and their elected leadership. NASA has been leading space exploration for over 50 years now. If you total up the budgets of every other country and their space programs on the planet, NASA is greater than all the other space budgets, including Russia, China, all of Europe, South America, Canada, Japan. So we have a healthy space program. I think the key is focusing it on doing new and innovative things that return real value here on Earth.
But Scott Pace, what about NASA's decision not to fund, quote, flagship missions? Tell me what that means and what constraints it offers.
Well, there's a tension there in that the scientific community sets priorities amongst itself in what are called decadal surveys, and they argue among themselves to set what's the most important thing they want to look at in planetary science or astrophysics or whatever the field is. And so NASA doesn't pick its own science priorities. Those science priorities come from the community. And the problem is you start pushing and saying, well, what are the most ambitious, cutting-edge things we can possibly do? Well, all the easy stuff has been done. So you're always, by definition, doing things that are really hard and are challenging, and that leads you to big missions or expensive missions. And Lori's correct. There are other innovative ways of doing science, and those are being explored. There's partnerships not only with the international community, but partnerships with the commercial community that can be done. But really, when you're talking about pushing the edge of science, like exploring for life on Europa, you're talking things that are big, big amounts of resources. And so the opportunities we're seeing out in front of us also reflect the fact that, we're talking the easier or less expensive options that might have been done have been done. And now leadership is pushing us out to the frontier of budgets as well as science.
So, Joel Achenbach, what about private space ventures? Can they not make up the gap?
Well, in space science, I don't think that the private sector is going to is going to suddenly send a probe to explore that ocean on Europa around Jupiter. Lori Garver here is one of the great proponents of, I think it's fair to say, commercial crew, the commercial sector, and having NASA help fund the private sector taking over the job of getting astronauts to low Earth orbit. Let me just go back to what the other two guests have said. The big problem with NASA in recent years, and everyone has told me this, and please disagree if you think this is wrong, is that it has so much that it's trying to do on a flat budget. So it's trying to develop a new heavy lift rocket, the Space Launch System. It's also trying to develop a new capsule, the Orion capsule. Meanwhile, it's trying to get the commercial sector, the commercial crew program going, and it does space science. That's about $5 billion a year. It has a lot of different things it's trying to do, and it doesn't seem that it's able to do all of them. And so there's lots of little compromises. Mm. Schedules slip. Mm. You have said that, Lori, specifically in my article that we ran just a few weeks ago, that the decision to go forward with SLS and Orion with that, and try to do everything else, created a crunch for NASA.
Sure, of course. It's all about trade-offs. And at this point, NASA, after 55 years, has a number of constituencies that we have fed for a long time. We said space isn't really partisan, it's parochial. And if you have, in the human spaceflight area, grown up developing big rockets, you want to keep developing them. It's really not that different on the science side. If you're a Mars scientist, you want to keep having NASA fund your Mars missions and keep redoing, for instance, what we just did with Curiosity is now planned again for 2020 instead of what you could be doing, going driving in a new direction on Europa. Those are the trade-offs. We make those trade-offs in every other public policy arena. You know, Farmers look for farm subsidies? You bet. Do mortgage bankers look for better tax breaks for mortgages? You bet. And planetary scientists and human spaceflight people look for money for what they're already doing. NASA needs to push and do new things and be less about the status quo and the already developed constituencies and keeping them fed. As long as we're doing that, we aren't going to have the money to do new things.
But if NASA is science-oriented and the private organizations are looking for profit-making devices, aren't you on two different paths? And isn't NASA sort of left behind?
Well, this is where it's important to have really a political discussion as to what are the things you want NASA to do. Science is part of what NASA does. Promoting technology and innovation is also something NASA does. NASA was created as a Cold War response to the challenge of the Soviet Union. So NASA, for many years, has been a geopolitical tool of presidents. The space station program is not purely a science effort. In fact, many scientists have their own skepticism about station, although I think they'll be proved wrong. But it was also an international and foreign policy tool. Bringing the Russians into the space station was a way of symbolizing having a post-Soviet relationship with Russia. So foreign policy, science, innovation, economic stimulation, these are all the different mission areas, if you will, that NASA has been asked to perform. And so the multiple programs and projects that NASA then gets asked to do with limited budgets are reflective of those different policy initiatives, if
you
will.
So, for example, should NASA be thinking about sending an astronaut to the moon?
Well, I think NASA should be doing that, but the reason for that is not simply because I have a fondness for lunar science, but because I think it could meet an important international objective, which is bringing other countries along with us, particularly emerging space powers such as India, and I'll also say it, China, NASA can and should be a foreign policy tool of the United States, and I think a human return to the moon poses some opportunities for international outreach in ways that asteroid or Mars missions right now cannot.
How do you feel about that, Lori? A man on the moon, returning to the moon?
I think it was a great goal in the 1960s, and I think we achieved it, and there was a purpose for it, and as soon as we have a purpose to go back, we will do that.
You don't think there is such a purpose now?
I don't think there is a driving purpose for us to land someone on the moon in a way that, as we did in the 60s, spent 5% of the national budget.
Joel.
Well, I'm curious, Scott, do you think it was a mistake to cancel the Constellation program? Is that correct? And maybe, Lori, you could discuss that decision, because that is such a big moment for NASA in recent years, when President Obama said, we are not going to go back to the moon, which was the program under President Bush. It was to build a couple new rockets and go back to the moon. So I'm curious what you think about that decision.
Well, I think there's really two different parts. I mean, the short answer is, yes, I thought canceling Constellation was a mistake. But you have to distinguish Constellation from the broader vision for space exploration. So there really are two different things. There's what are you doing in human spaceflight, you know, going to the moon, on to Mars, asteroids, and so forth. And then there's a different strategy you could take, which the Augenstein Committee talked about, and which the Obama administration also talked about. And then there's the particular program that you would put together to do that strategy. So I think that the Constellation program was reflective of a particular way of doing the vision for space exploration. I think there are other ways you could have done that. But I think the Obama administration really did two things. They chose a different program and they chose a different strategy.
Scott Pace, he's director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. He served as associate administrator for program analysis and evaluation at NASA from 2005 to 2008. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I know we have lots of callers waiting and emails as well, but we'll talk a little more and bring your calls in as soon as we can. Joel Achenbach at the Washington Post is here. Lori Garver, general manager for the Airline Pilots Association. She was NASA deputy administrator from 2009 to 2013. And Scott Pace, director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. Coming back to you, Joel, you wrote in an article that NASA has, quote, middle-aged problems. What do you mean by that?
Maybe I was projecting a little bit there, but I think if you look at the early years of NASA, from Sputnik to Apollo 11, Sputnik is 1957. 12 years later, there are astronauts walking on the moon. Incredible momentum in those early years. NASA was founded in 1958. And it was so exciting. And then it's always kind of had a problem figuring out what to do after Apollo 11, after the Apollo program. So they came up with the idea of the space shuttle. The visionaries wanted to go on to Mars. There was this whole idea that Mars was the next step, astronauts on Mars. But very expensive, very challenging.
Sure.
And so they came up with the idea of the shuttle and then the International Space Station. The space station has always been controversial, although I think most people that I talked to for our series in the Post said they thought it was an engineering triumph. I mean, really, amazing feat of engineering.
But what happens on that space station?
Well, they do scientific experiments. They study the effects on the human body of weightlessness. It's also an international collaboration, which Scott mentioned earlier, is an important part of the space program. And I think in terms of whether it will ever justify the $100 billion that we put into it, that's up in the air, but give it time. The question is, how long will it fly? Right now, it's funded through 2020, and when the funding runs out, they'll have to crash it into the South Pacific, which will be a really interesting moment. It'll probably be extended, I'm guessing, and it may be till 2028 or so.
Laurie?
To me, I feel like the space program has been and still should be about doing those innovative things and expanding the frontier outward. We have done that in our early days at NASA, certainly, and allowed for tens of billions of dollars of industry to develop. Everything we do today involves space activities. We call it the space program. We're really maybe just talking about human spaceflight because that is looking for, I think, a why. What is our value? We knew what it was in Apollo, but there has only been a brief period of time where NASA had a destination and a timeline that we were working toward. That doesn't necessarily have to be repeated. We've tried, many presidents have tried to set those kind of goals and destinations, and the programs have not been able to move forward because there isn't that need. The true why of human spaceflight is, I think, what people really are struggling to gain at this point.
Scott, you mentioned international competition that's driving us. Why is that so important?
Well, I think it's because the rules in any new environment are made by the people who show up, not by the people who stay behind. And I'm in an international affairs school now, and some of the more interesting problems in foreign affairs these days are areas that are beyond traditional sovereignty, things of the high seas, the air, polar regions, space. And there are many, many more countries that are getting into the space business these days, a much more globalized activity, very international activity. The UN Committee on Space is probably one of the largest ones in the UN system. And I think that it's deeply in the U.S. interest to have space be a stable, quiet, and peaceful environment because we as a country are very reliant on space economically for our national security as well as for doing science and innovation and other things. So if we want to shape that environment for whatever it is the U.S. Is going to pursue, it's important to bring other countries along with us. So it's very different than the Cold War environment. Laurie is absolutely correct in pointing out the difference between today and where we were during the Cold War. But I think we're facing a new series of geopolitical challenges, and it's important to pursue both our security interests in space as well as our commercial and civil cooperation interests to shape that environment in ways that are going to be in long-term U.S. national interest.
Jill.
So but, for our recent story, John Grunsfeld, who is the NASA Associate Administrator for Science, he runs the whole science operation at NASA. He said very directly that science should be at the core of the mission of NASA. Not that human spaceflight is not important, but that historically human spaceflight has been the sort of center of gravity at NASA. And he says, why not let the scientific questions be at the center, working with the human spaceflight side of things to answer big questions, including, for example, if we could send an astronaut to Mars, let that astronaut be a scientist. And I'd be curious to know what the other two guests think about that. Is it realistic? And specifically, I think one thing that jumps out from the last year is the asteroid redirect mission, which is this very elaborate, complicated mission of capturing a rock, bringing it back to lunar orbit, having astronauts visit it in the new Orion capsule launched by the new SLS rocket in lunar orbit sometime in the 2020s. Grunsfeld said last year at a conference, he said, this is not a science mission. And I think there's a real question of whether that mission will ever actually happen. But doesn't it make sense to build missions around what is it you're trying to achieve, rather than around, well, what do we already have going on? Let's see how we can weave them together.
Well, it's It would be a difficult proposition to shift the entire NASA budget to focus on science, and it would be definitely something new. If you look at human spaceflight, it has been driven more, as Scott was saying, on geopolitical goals. If NASA is going to be only for science, you look at the federal tax dollar, we spend a fraction of NASA's budget on the entire National Science Foundation. So I think NASA would be looking at a much smaller budget profile if our only constituency were science. I do believe, as it drives right now about $5 billion of the NASA budget, that it should be focused on doing new things. And it often is something, unfortunately, that is shaped more by the status quo and not doing new things, because that's the way we get our federal dollars. People who have money want to keep getting it.
I want to read for you an email from Mark in Dallas, who wants us to, at least for part of the hour, discuss the unmanned science missions. He says, while NASA has done a better job of publicizing these missions than they used to, I still find a lot of the general public think all NASA ever did was fly the space shuttle. The majority of science and research NASA does comes from small and mid-sized, by NASA standard, missions. Yet whenever NASA has to cut back on its budget, these are the first on the chopping block. Joel Achenbach's story in The Post points out how NASA has spent more than $3.5 billion over 15 years to build the Cassini mission to fly to Saturn, and now are threatening to turn it off 4 years early just to save $60 million, less than 2% of the total cost. Lori.
There are budgets within the science program that I think should be expanding. And right now you have earth sciences and heliophysics, two areas that don't get a lot of attention, that are growing and that we have invested in, that we believe is going to return that great value. NASA has done a good job on its planetary missions, being able to connect with the public. I think the Mars Curiosity is the best recent example. Kepler also, though, as Joel outlined, is returning this unbelievably amazing new information about exoplanets and potential of life elsewhere in the universe. Asteroids are that part of the universe that do impact, in many ways, life on Earth. We know it has in the past, and that's the reason we have targeted asteroids for increases in our detection and our ability to potentially go there, not only with robots, but ultimately with humans.
Any comment, Joel?
Yeah, point one thing out, which is that the planetary science budget took a hit after the main cost of Curiosity went down, after they got the rover ready to go. The planetary science budget did go down rather precipitously, and they have been lobbying, the scientists who work on planetary missions, lobbying very feverishly for an uptick in their budget. We'll see what happens. But the problem is that, first of all, Curiosity ran nearly $1 billion over budget. And then over in the astrophysics side of things, the James Webb Space Telescope is many billions of dollars over budget and delayed by a number of years. So these science missions themselves have had some sins with the budget, and that's hurt everyone.
And joining us now from his office here in Washington, D.C., Mike Gold. He's Director of D.C. Operations and Business Growth for Bigelow Aerospace. Hi there, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Happy New Year, Diane. Happy it's a New pleasure Year. And honor to be on.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about Bigelow Aerospace. What is the mission of the company?
Well, we are exclusively dedicated to developing expandable space habitats, which are next-generation habitat technology that will both reduce costs and increase capacity for commercial or governmental operations in low Earth orbit, the asteroids, the moon, or beyond. So it's something that in this budget environment where you want to decrease costs, increase capacity, should be very good. We have two spacecraft in orbit already, and will soon, I can now say that it's 2014, next year, we will be sending a prototype to the International Space Station.
And what about the relationship between NASA and commercial enterprises like yours?
It's been very important. I think whether it's SpaceX or Bigelow Aerospace or even any of the traditional companies, there's a critical line between them. I think the best representation of it is our International Space Station mission, where we are building a prototype module that will be launched on a SpaceX vehicle and then attached to the International Space Station, where expandable habitat technology for the first time will be demonstrated in a crewed context. And that's an example of government and the private sector working together to try and leverage the best of both worlds.
And you talk a lot about habitats. Critics are saying that private ventures are far more interested in profit rather than science. How do you respond?
I don't want to start out by laughing, but that would be, I think, the most appropriate response to an accusation like that. I think whether it's an entrepreneur like Elon Musk or my boss, Mr. Bigelow, there are certainly many, many easier ways to make money than in the aerospace industry. The old joke goes that if you want to make a small fortune in aerospace, you begin with a large one. So while profit is important, particularly for sustaining these activities and moving them forward, I think there's a strong focus in the greater good and in getting this done, and that's why many of the entrepreneurs are in this industry in the first place. And I think, unlike NASA, I've heard accusations of, well, we'll, you know, cut safety in favor of profit. Just the opposite is the case.
All right. And I think Joel Achenbach has a question.
I would just wonder if you could address the comment that Mr. Bigelow made when he was in Washington recently, when he talked about how individuals should be able to own the moon, that the moon should be up for grabs as a sort of a real estate proposition. Can you explain what he was saying?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Happy New Year to you too, Joel.
All right.
First of all, when we say property rights, I think we have to clarify what, you know, Mr. Bigelow was talking about, what we're hoping for. And let's go back throughout history. You know, I think for those of Mr. Bigelow's generation, even of my own, we had hoped by now that, you know, we would be having this conversation on Mars instead of Washington, D.C. And the real push to the moon and beyond hasn't happened as people in the Apollo generation envisioned. And as you look at exploration from a historical context, what has been missing? I mean, every other push that we've had into new frontiers has been based on the ability to gain leverage and utilize property. And that's something that I think has been sorely missing from the space push. And
Mike,
when Mr. Bigelow...
Isn't there an international treaty that essentially says you can't own the moon?
Indeed, there is. It's the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, and that's why I think it's important to clarify what we essentially use as shorthand when we say property rights. What Mr. Bigelow and I think other investors will look for is a safe and secure environment where if we put the money into developing systems and base on the moon, that we will be able to operate on a non-interference and non-impingement basis. Not that you own it, which, as you point out, you can't do under the treaty, but at the very least that we wouldn't face interference from other domestic entities. And that sort of authorization, coordination for safety is already done by the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation and is frankly mandated by the treaty.
I'm not sure I really understand, Mike. The language that you're using sounds fairly proprietary, and I'm not sure that I understand what you mean when you use that language in regard to the moon, which, as Joel says, cannot be owned.
Yeah. Let me back up a step and say that whenever there is a commercial launch, the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation issues a license for that launch. Right now, under existing FAA regs, you can't get a license for putting up a payload or a satellite or a spacecraft within 200 kilometers of a manned or mannable object, particularly the International Space Station. And what Mr. Bigelow was looking for, and what we're referencing again using the shorthand of property rights, is that if we develop a manned system on the moon, that we can operate with the assurance that there won't be other domestic activities interfering in our zone of operation.
That sounds pretty confusing to me. Mike Gold, Director of DC Operations and Business Growth for Bigelow Aerospace. Thanks for joining us. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and by the Pew Charitable Trusts, analyzing state spending on healthcare and exploring innovative ways to manage these costs at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
Many Americans have been introduced to the world of British servants from TV series like Downton Abbey and Upstairs Downstairs. At the beginning of the 20th century, domestic service was the largest single occupation in Great Britain. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Lucy Lethbridge about her new book, Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Join us.
Welcome back. We're talking about the future of NASA, what its mission is going to be with reduced funding, how it's going to meet the expectations of a nation which is filled with many constituencies, all of which need, want money. How do you know what to cut, Lori? How do you know what constituencies in at the beginning of 2014 are going to serve the nation best of all going forward?
Well, I think the great thing about the United States and our history is we know how to advance economically in a capitalist environment. And NASA shouldn't be separated out and be just trying to relive Apollo and doing it in a way like those we beat did it in a socialist way. I think it's very clear that the investment NASA makes returns to our economy. A strong economy is a strong nation, and that is where NASA should bend its pick.
What programs do you believe should be cut?
To me, I think those particular programs that are built on previous technology. Right now, we are building a huge rocket called the Space Launch System,
The SLS.
It was something that Congress dictated to NASA, it had to do with the Orion spacecraft. It is a holdover from Constellation, which the Obama administration tried to cancel, and it's $3 billion a year of NASA's $17 billion. Is that how you would be investing in the space program? Where is it going to go? When will it even fly?
Give me a second program you'd cut.
I think at this point, I would not redo the Curiosity mission. I would invest that planetary science mission in doing something new like Europa.
Jill.
Or going to Mars in a more creative and innovative way where we can, again, drive technology.
Just to clarify, so that in 2020 there's going to be another rover on Mars that's essentially a duplicate of the one we have there now, Curiosity. And so Lori is saying that that's not a mission that she would have chosen. But I'm curious to ask Scott, so Lori is pretty emphatic that she would not have funded this new heavy lift rocket, the SLS and Orion. What's your position on that?
Well, the problem is that, first of all, if we're going to be going to Mars eventually, if someone wants to have a heavy lift, someone wants to do a human mission to Mars, you basically do need a heavy lift vehicle. And I think people can argue about, when do you need that? Do you need that heavy lift vehicle, today? Or could you have waited later? And one of the brilliant things I thought about Constellation was that you really built a smaller vehicle first, the Ares 1, which allowed you to go back to the moon. That put much of the down payment for a heavy lift vehicle that you later could do for going to Mars. You allowed time for a commercial crew and cargo systems to develop. It was a very, very tightly integrated system that proceeded out in a logical fashion. But that's not where we are today.
Okay, but
the rocket is so similar, and it's built off of 1970s technology. The very engines we're going to use are space shuttle engines that were developed in the 1970s. Would you really go to Mars with a technology that's 50 years old? That's not what innovation and our space exploration program should be all about.
All right, I'm going to open the phones first to Jerry in Adena, Ohio. You're on the air.
Good morning. Wonderful show. I think that we are thinking too small. We need to employ the planet. We need to build everything in space, an international space station, go to Mars. With the possibility that something catastrophic could happen to this planet is looming, and they show it every day on the science shows. We need to think big. We need to get the planet employed. That's basically my comment.
What do you think there, Scott Pace?
Well, I think there's an issue that's come up in the last couple of years, greater awareness of the importance of planetary defense. We've seen that asteroids and objects can come and hit and cause damage on the Earth. And most of the scientific community is pretty well on the same page that the idea is find them early, find them often, find them early. And so doing more survey work on asteroids and understanding their objects and being able to do something about them is certainly a worthwhile goal.
I just like to say that I resist the idea that that the Earth may be doomed and we need to have a second chance somewhere else. I think that gives up on this planet a little quickly, and I think it's not very realistic that we're going to colonize Mars or any other planet anytime in our lifetime or in our children's lifetimes. And I think that although certainly we all care about the preservation of our species, I think we also should care about the preservation of all the life on Earth and the biodiversity that we are causing a major decline in as we speak. So the notion that there's another landing spot for the human species because something bad might happen here, I'm not terribly sympathetic to that view.
Here's a comment on exactly that from Nathan in Durango, Colorado. Hi there.
Hi, Diane. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks.
Happy New Year. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks.
So my question / comment for you and the panelists is this. With Earth coming close to, if not already reaching, carrying capacity, shouldn't we be putting more funding into exploration for resources to sustain this growing population and further down the road colonization so that with a growing population on a planet that doesn't have the resources to support the numbers of citizens, should we be looking further out in the frontier?
That's exactly in contrast to what you've just said, Jill.
I think we need to have a sustainable planet here. I think if we become a two-planet species and don't solve the problem of sustainability, we just have a bigger arena for our problem.
What do you think, Scott Pace?
Well, I think the question is there a human future in space? And we really don't know. We have people who hope and think that there will be one. But we need to answer questions about whether or not humans can live beyond the planet Earth, if that's even possible, for long periods of time. And we need to find things that are commercially useful to do. Can we pay for this in some way? If we can answer yes to both those questions, then we get space colonies, we get space settlements.
And do you think the private sector is going to move more quickly than the federal government on those issues?
Well, I would certainly hope so. If they can't beat the federal government, then there's something wrong. But I think they should be given the opportunity. And the thing is, we simply don't know. The purpose of exploration, the purpose of trying out new markets, is to find out whether or not there is a human future beyond this planet.
But see, that brings back into question the relationship between the private companies and the federal government. Are they really working together or totally at different purposes, Lori?
Well, I believe that in this country we have chosen, absolutely, that the government should be working productively with the private sector. And whether that is just us buying things from the public sector or just regulating from the private sector, that's certainly an area that we look at across the board. In my view, NASA has worked with the private sector successfully for its entire history. That just needs to evolve. We need to find ways to incentivize the private sector to do more. If you look at aviation, I think yesterday was the 100th anniversary of commercial aviation. So that was commercialized within 11 years of the first flight. Now we are the first commercial space flight for a human was 40 years after the first space flight. We should be able to capitalize with the private sector on these new markets. The caller mentioned resource utilization. That's an area the private sector has an interest in. Tourism is certainly already happened, but it's Russia who's been capitalizing on it. The U.S. is going to be able to do that as we get launch costs down. And the way to get launch costs down is to let the private sector innovate, which is what NASA's doing. It's an incredibly valuable program.
To Mark in Oklahoma City. Hi there.
Hello.
Go right ahead, sir.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. You all touched on the International Space Station earlier, and also you had the phrase the Apollo Generation, which I'm old enough to be a part of, and I get the impression, well, these many years, that the succession of NASA administrators failed to grasp what I would think would be the key to the success of NASA, which is to capture the public imagination in favor of a kind of bureaucratic response that the purpose of NASA is to lobby certain members of Congress in certain districts to keep the funding stream to aerospace contractors. And you can't keep the funding stream and members and lobby members of Congress successfully if you lose the public imagination. And I think that, for one thing, the focus on the space station was not anywhere near as exciting as some of these planetary probe missions with exciting pictures that came back, or the Hubble telescope, or a variety of other things. It was just the International Space Station was just a huge money pit to keep the funding stream to aerospace contractors with no overall purpose other than the funding stream, and therefore lost the public imagination.
All right. Thanks for calling, Mark.
Yeah, I make one quick comment, which is that back in 2004, I think it was, and Scott mentioned this earlier, the vision for space exploration, there was a real attempt at NASA to come up with a new era based on exploration, doing really cool new stuff in deep space, getting out of low Earth orbit. I think there was a recognition that the space shuttle program and the space station program did not fulfill all of NASA's potential to excite people and to go new places. But even when the Constellation program was put together, which was built around the idea, let's go back to the moon and then eventually to Mars, the public was never fully invested in going back to the moon. And I remember writing in the Washington Post that it was unclear if this would actually happen because it was a program you could imagine being canceled in the future by some future Congress or some future president. And that is exactly what happened. It got canceled because and when it can't, I don't think the public went into an uproar when the moon mission, the Constellation mission was canceled. So whatever NASA does, if it tries to do something really big and bold, like a human mission to Mars, if it tries to do that, it needs to have that public support and public excitement.
All right. Tell me a little about SpaceX.
Well, SpaceX is interesting because Elon Musk, who runs SpaceX, is the founder of it, he knows exactly what he wants to do, which he wants to go to Mars. He wants to put thousands of people on Mars. He's very much a believer in, I think, what one of the earlier callers referred to, which is let's make ourselves a multiplanetary species. So he's not going to go to the moon. I don't think that SpaceX has any plans to go to the moon. And thanks in part to NASA's programs, the commercial crew and commercial cargo programs, SpaceX has done an amazing work. They have thousands of people working for them now, and so they're definitely one to watch.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's see. Mike has a question. He's in St. Louis. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I'm glad you're having the discussion. I've been trying to have this discussion in the public arena for many years, and it's really about the vision. We went to the moon, which was a political thing, and it was an amazing thing. It was the first time we stepped outside of onto a celestial body, and we've done that. And so further out places just don't have the public imagination possibilities, especially in our virtual world. We're having this conversation virtually right now. We're all talking to each other. We're doing almost so many things of our life now are virtual, and we don't even appreciate the fact that why would we want to heave a human being in its current configuration all the way out to Mars just for really entertainment? The things that we can do virtually are so much beyond. And it's really an opportunity cost, spending the billions and billions and billions of dollars that it would take to do that for really what end versus using that money to understand who we are and to build maybe more Hadron colliders and things that we can do here on Earth where we as humans still belong. We will project ourselves intellectually into space, but it won't be as 200-pound biological bodies.
Interesting. What do you think, Lori?
Well, to me, I think there is a human imperative to explore, but you're correct. We're doing it now in so many ways virtually. And I think where we can do it virtually we do, and we reserve those places to spend, at least from the taxpayer's perspective, the billions of dollars for human spaceflight on those things that return value. So, no, I don't think we should keep reliving the past. It is a very romantic time of Apollo, and we have a lot of nostalgia for it. But it's a little like why I also have a lot of nostalgia for big, heavy, old cars. But and they're not what we need today.
Tell me how successful Elon Musk has been so far.
Well, SpaceX just a few weeks ago launched a commercial satellite into geosynchronous orbit, and it seems to be poised to capture a big piece of the military and national security launch business, which currently has been monopolized by United Launch Alliance, which is a Boeing-Lockheed joint operation. And so there's a lot of money in that for SpaceX, and so they've gone from being a startup to being a major player in the business. And I think that Elon, if you go into their offices, they have pictures of Mars on the wall, including they have a picture of Mars as it has been terraformed with water and plants and so on, because they could imagine that the human destiny is there. Now, that seems to me a little bit fantastic in the literal sense, but certainly there's a lot of drive there in that company to do just that.
What do you think, Scott? How successful might that company be?
Well, I think the thing that's really interesting about SpaceX is, and has not really been commented on a lot, is their successful commercial launches, the launch of the SES telecom satellite earlier. The U.S. has largely been driven from the international marketplace in terms of competing for international launches in comparison to French and Russian suppliers. If a U.S. company, if SpaceX, is able to take back market share in the internationally competed market, I think that will be hugely, hugely important and very, very helpful.
Lori, Last comment.
That's the absolute key, doing things in new ways. They've taken what would have been a hundreds of billions of dollar launch and hundreds of millions and made it 60 million. And that is going to help the United States. And that is what we should be doing in our space program, is driving innovation and help this country, again, lead the world.
Lori Garver, she was NASA deputy administrator from 2009 to 2013. She's now with the Airline Pilots Association. Joel Achenbach at the Washington Post. His occasional series is called Destination Unknown, all about NASA and the future of space exploration. And Scott Pace, director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. Thank you all, and a Happy New Year.
Thank you, Diane.
Happy New Year.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Ring.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora